supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got another one of those jam-packed shows for you today, cats and kittens. In the question of the week, we will discuss those beloved wild violets and explain yet another reason why you should embrace these weeds in your landscape. We're also going to discuss proper tree planting that could save you thousands of dollars a couple of years from now. It's a lot to do, so let's hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Elliot, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you for having me, Mike.
Well, thank you for being had, Elliot. Where are you, sir?
Well, at the moment, I'm in Michigan, where I used to live until a year and a half ago, and I had to go down to Florida to take care of the old folks.
Right.
And then my mom was pretty old, and she passed, and so I inherited her wild rose bush.
Okay. And is the wild rose bush in Florida or Michigan?
It's in Florida.
Okay. Very good. So what's going on with this rose bush down in Florida?
Well, the first thing I should tell you is that I'm not much of a gardener, and I don't know much about them. I knew I was supposed to keep it watered, and I did. And then I even made the mistake when all sorts of red leaves turned up of cutting them off. And then I heard that I shouldn't do that because those are new leaves. But the bush survived my mistakes and bloomed nicely. And then about 4 or 5 months ago, all of a sudden, morning and evening, they would get attacked by little bees that paid no attention to the rose flowers, but were all over the leaves. And I didn't know what to make of that because they're bees, and I figured they were good for the bush. And then on your previous show, I heard that there was a phenomenon called biting bees.
Well, I think you mean leaf cutter bees. There is a species of bee and a species of ant that are called leaf cutters, and what they do is they make very clean slices out of the leaves of different plants, and they use them in as food in the case of the ants, and I think as nesting material in the case of the bees. Now, are your little bees actually injuring the plant?
From what I can tell, yes. I've been out there in the early evening and in the morning, about an hour past sunrise, and these bees swarm the plant, and they land on the leaves only and on each other only, and next thing I know, there are sharp cuts in the leaf and in leaves all over the plant.
Now, this is a curious phenomenon. And so far, you haven't noticed any lack of production of the actual roses themselves, right?
Well, I don't think so. But then again, I don't know what a reasonable expectation is. I can tell you that there have been between 4 and 12 roses pretty much on the plant all around.
I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine back in the 90s, and one of the most fascinating research articles I ever had a chance to read was a study where they took two fields of alfalfa, and in one field they sprayed the heck out of it until they saw no insects whatsoever. The other field they left alone. And they said they charted the presence of all these different alfalfa pests. And at the end of the season, they harvested the fields and weighed the usable alfalfa. And the field that had not been sprayed produced more grain. So they came to the conclusion a little bit of feeding by an insect, especially on the non-target parts of the plant. Obviously, it'd be different if they were going after the flower buds. But when insects come along and do a little bit of feeding or removal on the leaves, it can often stimulate a response that in the end will give you more roses.
Uh-huh.
And I would also expect that their leaf cutting period, the time during which they're gathering this material, is going to be relatively short. This isn't going to be a year-long or a two-month-long problem. They're going to come along, right, and they're going to take their leaves, and they're going to be done. And in the end, they will have stimulated your rose bush, perhaps, to produce more roses. So this is a classic situation where I would just observe this wonderful phenomena of nature, enjoy the extra roses, and not look for trouble where none exists.
A recommendation to leave well enough alone is a great recommendation. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Elliot. Great story, man.
All right. Have a good day.
1-888-346-9499. Carol, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Carol. How are you?
Well, fine, except for my little problem.
Okay, well, in what location do you have this little problem?
Prospect Park, Pennsylvania.
And what is prospecting in Carol's park?
Ants by the thousands and carpenter bees, but mostly the ants.
Okay, now, when you say ants, do you mean garden variety ants, or do you think you have carpenter ants?
No, well, the little tiny kind of ants, whatever, they're almost like what we used to call picnic ants.
Right, exactly. I call them garden variety ants because I think I'm clever. You know?
Okay. Okay, but they're by the thousands. They're in every flower pot. You pick up a flower pot, they're under there. When you move the flower pot or go to water a flower pot, oh, they come all over your hands real fast. And some of them sometimes even come in the house. I've seen them in the bathtub. So in the bathtub, I put little saucers of vinegar, and that keeps them away.
Mm-hmm.
But I do not know what to do about outside. I put boric acid all around the edge of the foundation. That did not help.
Right, because you didn't use it correctly.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So here's what we're going to do. Normally, I tell people to chill when they have outside ants. But I can tell it sounds like you've got multiple colonies out there. They're setting up little infant raising stations in your potted plants. And yes, the ants can get very territorial and defensive when they're trying to raise their young. And it sounds like you may have too many.
No, so, way too many.
Right. You'll never get rid of ants by attacking the workers directly. You have to get the workers to kill the queens. You want to go to a garden center or a home store, and you want to get boric acid bait traps. These are pre-mixed concoctions, and what you get is a very tiny dose of boric acid mixed with a sweet, sugary bait that the ants are attracted to. Now, the dose of boric acid is so low that it's not going to kill the worker ants. They will sample this sweet bait, and then they will take it back to the nest, and it'll be fed to all the other ants and the queen. And this is when you have to, like, go on vacation or not look at them, because during this time, you have to let the ants come and go so that they can carry a lot of this boric acid bait back to the nest. And it won't have any effect on them right away, but on like day five or six, the first ant who tried this stuff is going to be going, "Yo, Marty, I don't feel too good." And then one by one, they're going to drop. And then it's too late because the boric acid is already in the queen.
What do these traps look like? Are they something that goes in the ground, or you set them inside the pots?
Sometimes you'll get a squirt jar of liquid that you'll use to fill little jar caps. Sometimes they'll be self-contained. Just boric acid bait traps. The active ingredient will say boron, sodium tetraborate, boric acid. It'll be some variation of the element boron, not a whole bunch of chemical numbers and letters. Now, but very important, because we're going to be using this outside, we want to protect bees. So you can use the same baits. These are the baits that you would use inside. But outside, just put a shoebox or something like that over top of them.
Okay.
Because you know the ants are everywhere. They'll get in there.
Oh yeah.
And they'll take it back, but that'll prevent bees from landing in it because bees could be harmed by the boric acid. But
okay.
Other than that, it's completely harmless.
Okay. Now, can I ask you a question about the carpenter bees that are drilling and making Swiss cheese out of my split rail fence?
Right, which is unpainted wood.
But it was pressure treated.
Well, it's not. That's not safe for you to touch then. But, you know, the ways to keep bees, carpenter bees, from making galleries in wood is pretty much to paint the wood. And since they already have galleries in it, what I would suggest is if the fencing is good enough to save, that you have somebody fill it in, you know, with putty or whatever to fill in the holes and the gaps.
Okay.
And then have it painted. They won't go into the wood after it's been painted.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay, good luck, Carol.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll be doing a very special meet and greet and answering your garden questions live and in person on Saturday, August 2nd, beginning around 4 p.m. as part of the 10th annual Iron Hill Twilight Bike Race and Street Festival in downtown Westchester, PA. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with how to plant a tree properly. The culprit that you would love to have around that ate a listener's wild violets, and more of your fascinating phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for WHYY's You Bet Your Garden is made possible by Burpee. Burpee is committed to providing all things needed for planting and growing your garden. Seeds, plants, supplies, videos, and more are online at burpee.com. And Summit Responsible Solutions. Summit Mosquito Dunks and Mosquito Bits contain BTI, which naturally controls mosquitoes without harming other living things, including people and pets. Online at summitresponsiblesolutions.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, the mysterious case of the missing violets. Who ate our listener's violets? And why is she going to be happy when she finds out who the culprit was? We're also going to take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But right now, it is time to plant a tree correctly. Helping us do that is going to be Kyla Cruz, Communications Director for the Energy Ed Council, talking about selecting the right tree for the right place in your yard. Kyla, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, thank you so much, Mike.
So you guys sent out a release around Arbor Day talking about all the rational choices people should make to plant trees, and it's taken us a little while to catch up with you. the first thing I want to mention before we get to your information is, for God's sake, don't anybody plant a tree right now. This is probably the only time of year when you don't want to be actively planting a tree. But the fall that is coming up is, in my opinion, I don't know how you guys feel, an even better time for planting trees than the spring.
I've heard that as well from horticulturists and arborists. And, of course, we recommend doing this sort of planning that we'll be talking about prior to the planting season anyway. So this is really perfect timing to be talking about this.
Right. That's one of the biggest problems I see is people go to, like, a big box store and they see, like, a runt tree, or they see a tree on sale, or they just see a tree and take it home, not thinking that this should have been, like, a kitchen table discussion and mapped out planting thing 2 months before planting time.
Absolutely. I mean, you want to incorporate some site planning that's going to fit your needs and your yard, but then also do some research on the type of trees that will be best not only for your hardiness zone, but for the intent, whether it be shade, whether it be proximity to power lines, which, of course, here at the Energy Education Council is very important to us.
Yeah, but nobody's going to plant a tree so that they can interfere with the power lines. It just happens that half of them do so.
It's something that you really need to know, do the research, know what it's going to look like in 10 years, in 20 years, to be able to plan and have the right tree in the right place.
So now the purpose of your organization, the Energy Education Council, is, I guess, twofold. One, if there's overhead power lines, you don't want people to plant tall trees within 20 feet of them. And second, something we don't talk about enough on this show that I think we should mention is the national 811 number. Call before you dig. Tell us how that works.
You bet. Before you ever put a shovel in the ground, you want to make that call to 811 or go online to their website as well and put in a request to have underground utility lines marked. And that usually takes a couple of business days, a few business days in advance to have that done. But those lines will be marked, those public utilities. You'll know where they're at and you can take care to avoid them for both safety and reliability.
One of the resources that I think is neat, I wasn't really aware of this, you say the Arbor Day Foundation has an online tree wizard tool that'll help you select the best tree for your needs?
Yes, it's called the Best Tree Finder, and it allows you to enter your zip code and what type of tree that you're interested in, what kind of conditions you have as far as soil type and sun exposure. And then it has suggestions of what trees will help best meet your needs. Good trees are good investments, and to be able to get the most enjoyment and benefit out of them, it's worth doing the planning and the research ahead of time.
Now, in your experience, a couple things you talk about in your material is planting a tree for a windbreak. And that's something we often don't talk about enough, unless we get a phone call from Oklahoma. And then the first thing I explain to them is, of course, your plants are dying. Your wind is 120 miles an hour on a calm day.
You bet. Windbreaks are great for that, for energy costs, as are shade trees in the summer. Providing that shade, that cooling effect for your home will also help in cooling costs.
Right, and here you say to plant shade trees to the east and west of your home to block the strongest parts of the sun the best.
That's right. Again, it goes back to picking that right tree to begin with. It can help you not only aesthetically maintain the look of that tree, but also functionally as well.
And again, your organization will help people determine the correct planting distance.
Correct.
Okay, so that's the energyedcouncil.org. And to select the right tree, contact your local state extension office and visit arborday.org and look at their tree wizard tool. All right, Kyla Cruz, Communications Director for the Energy Ed Council. Thanks for being on You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And now back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Genevieve, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you very much. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Genevieve. Where are you?
I'm in Allentown, Pennsylvania.
Very good. What can we do for Genevieve in Allentown?
My husband and I recently bought a house, and it's a really, really nice house, but it's in the woods. And I grew up in, like, kind of your normal lawn type situation, and so did my husband, so we're not really used to, like, a woodsy environment. The trees are really mature, and there's not a lot of sun that gets through, but there is some. And I was trying to think of ways to, like, get a decent-looking lawn even under those tall trees. And part of me was thinking, well, go with just, like, some kind of breed of grass that's really shady. And then another part of me went online and looked up moss. And I found this place that, like, does moss that you can basically start a lawn of moss. I never dealt with moss or anything, but have you ever heard of someone having a lawn made of moss, and how long would that take to grow, and would it be too expensive?
Moss lawns are great. We have done interviews with people who sell moss sod that you can lay down just like lawn sod. We've interviewed people who know the techniques of mixing up some existing native moss with buttermilk or beer and spreading.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because first of all, moss is very easy to grow in a damp, shady, acidic environment. It is the plant of choice that nature likes in damp, shady, acidic environments. If you don't have any moss there right now, you may have to acidify your soil a little bit with some peat moss or some sulfur. But then, if you have some moss that you like, or you buy this dried moss, and especially if you buy the dried moss, it would come with instructions to put it in a blender with a lot of water, and then a little bit, again, of beer or buttermilk to get the, like, the fermentation going, to get those natural cultures going.
Okay.
And then you would just pour it out, and the moss would begin to take hold. Now, I like to tell people that there are several disadvantages to moss. It's green all year long. You never have to feed it, and you never have to cut it. So if you can live with those things, actually, it is the perfect no-care, I'll even say lawn, because many people will call what they have a moss lawn. These are increasingly popular in the United States. They've always been popular in Asia, especially in Japan, and they fit the woodland environment very well. I'll also tell you that if you have really heavy tree cover, that even the most shade-tolerant grass needs 4 hours of sun a day. And that's for a very fine fescue, which is a very wispy kind of grass. You're not going to grow any type of turf that's resistant to foot traffic out there. But you've already been online, and you've already seen these moss suppliers, many of which who are local to Pennsylvania, I believe.
Yeah, actually, the one was right in northern Pennsylvania, which I'm excited about.
Right, so maybe you can visit there and see these mosses in nature. But I know these companies that cultivate and sell moss, they have several different varieties, some of which gets a little taller than some of the others, some of which will change colors, will have a reddish tint to it. I don't know if moss technically flowers, but there are types that look like they're flowering. And there's types that can handle a little bit of foot traffic. What you have to realize about moss is it does not have any kind of a root system. It does not go into the soil. It just sits on top of the soil. So, again, obviously you got shade. The Allentown area, your soil should already be on the acidic side. You may have to make it a little bit more so, but that's a can of corn. That's a piece of cake. And because of the shade, it's probably pretty moist back there on a constant basis. So one of the great things about a moss lawn is if you're looking at it through a picture window growing amongst the trees and the ferns, it's going to look like a lawn, but you're never going to have to feed it or cut it. And if it gets damaged, All you need is some moss from another area. Say, you know, you get a little dig out somewhere, you get a little divot. You just get some moss from another corner. You put it in that same blender with some buttermilk and some beer, and you fill it in like you're spackling a wall, you know.
Oh, that's really cool. Okay, well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right, my pleasure. Good luck now.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Joe, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike.
Hello, Joe. How are you, sir?
I'm fine, sir.
And where is Joe Fine?
Bowie, Maryland.
Bowie, Maryland, a very nice area just outside of Washington, D.C. What can we do for Joe in Bowie?
Well, I planted a garden this year, which included tomato plants, patty pan squash, zucchini, and spaghetti squash.
Mm-hmm.
And I've experienced blossom drop on the tomatoes. In addition to that, then on the squash and the zucchini, I've also experienced a blossom drop and then the fruit forming, but then dying. And the same with my also cucumbers, the same thing is happening. We get the blossoms and the fruit forms, and then it turns yellow and dies. Apparently, I'm thinking I got a soil problem of some sort.
That's interesting. That's not where my thoughts would go to.
Okay, well, since I'm not a complete total gardener, you can enlighten me.
Well, we've had a very wet year, both us in Pennsylvania and you in the Washington, D.C. area. And I can remember several downpours. It would have devastated my poor garden if I didn't grow in raised beds. So my first question to you is, are you growing in flat earth or raised beds?
It's flat earth.
Did you do anything to amend the soil?
Yeah, I put in some soil mixture, that sort of thing.
Well, that's kind of really vague. Tell me exactly what you did, Joe. Was this area a lawn? Was it a flower bed?
Yeah, it was a lawn. It was a lawn. It had been a garden bed before.
Okay.
But it was fallow for at least 5-7 years.
Right. And what did you do to get rid of the grass?
We just tilled it and threw it aside. We bought a bunch of potting mixture and tilled that in, and a little bit of fertilizer.
Okay, and the fertilizer was some sort of chemical fertilizer, I'm presuming?
Yeah, it was vegetable tomato fertilizer.
Okay. In a year like we have had, one of the benefits of having a raised bed garden is, first of all, that tilling had to uncover a bajillion weed seeds. That must be driving you crazy right now, right, Joe?
Well, there are weeds there, and we're, you know, I'm out there not on a daily basis, but certainly on a weekly basis, you know, taking care of them.
And how do the plants themselves look? Do they still have good color?
They look healthy, and that's what I don't understand.
Well, first of all, growing in flat ground is really treacherous when we have a wet season because it doesn't allow the roots of the plants to dry out. And it is not uncommon early in the season, especially for zucchini and other summer squash, to produce only male flowers. So although it may seem like a lot of stuff is happening, it's just the guys, and there haven't been a lot of girls show up to the prom yet. How did you lay out your garden? Are there at least lanes for you to walk down and areas for the plants to grow in?
Yeah, I can walk in between some of the plants, yeah.
What I'm going to suggest is, it's too late to start over this year, but I'm going to suggest you go out and get a nice load of compost, maybe a couple of bags of premium compost, maybe a small load of bulk compost from one of the, you have a lot of nice nurseries, independent nurseries and garden centers near you. Not manure, not composted manure. You want compost. What I want you to do is just around the plants, I want you to put an inch of compost all around the plants. And then if we start to dry out, that'll be good for you, first of all. I only want you to water it once a week deeply. Don't give it little waterings every day. Don't wet the leaves of your plants in the evening. You can wet them in the morning as long as the sun is going to dry them out right away. And then try not to walk too near your plants. Every time you step near your plant's roots, you're compressing the soil. All the things that you've described are signs of plant stress. Now, the compost as a mulch around them is going to do two things. It's going to give them a nice, gentle feeding. It's going to help them utilize their water better. But it's also going to be a sign for you not to walk there. And then next year, what I want you to do is just frame out a bunch of areas that are 4x8 and fill those with compost. Raise them 6 inches to a foot above the surrounding soil level. Give yourself 2 feet of walking lanes in between, and you will never have this problem again. And if we have these torrential floods in the spring, your plants will keep their heads above water while your neighbors go under and drown. So a little bit of compost, plan for raised beds next year, but don't worry about this. You still got a lot of season ahead. I think you're going to get a nice amount of produce out of this garden.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, good luck, Joe.
Thank you so much. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind gardeners with wilted lettuce, pooped-out peas, sad-looking spinach, and pitiful pansies that nothing's wrong. Once summer heat arrives in full force, the crops of cool weather go down like a clown. It's all part of the natural cycle of plant succession. So plant some fast-maturing summer crops like bush beans in their place, and be prepared to grow lots more of those great greens when the weather starts to cool down again, which will be sooner than you think and many of us want. Don't go looking for all the details under Season Extension in the Garden Answers A to Z section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fascinating phone call and the wonderful culprit that was eating wild violets. I'm Wild Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for WHYY's You Bet Your Garden is made possible by Burpee. Burpee is committed to providing all things needed for planting and growing your garden. Seeds, plants, supplies, videos, and more are online at burpee.com. And Summit Responsible Solutions. Summit Mosquito Dunks and Mosquito Bits contain BTI, which naturally controls mosquitoes without harming other living things, including people and pets. Online at summitresponsiblesolutions.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to intriguing question of the week. Many people want to get rid of wild violets. We have a listener whose wild violets got eaten before she could enjoy them. What's the culprit? Wait till she and you find out, which you will do after a couple more of these fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Mike, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Calling from northwestern Chester County.
Okay, Mike, very good. Nice to hear from you. What can we do you for?
We have a major die-off of the ash trees starting to happen.
Right.
Trying to find out, I guess, as a landowner, if there's any help available from, I don't know, county, state, power companies before these things become a serious nightmare in terms of property, power lines, you know, that situation.
You're worried about ash borers, the emerald ash borer, the imported
Correct.
Insect, and you've identified ash trees on your property.
Yep.
Have they been infected?
Yes.
Okay. Well, then the basic answer is once they are infected with the ash borer, yes, you need to get in touch. I believe the state will be the one to help you out the most. Hopefully, they will help you with the removal and the carting away and destruction. And I don't know off the top of my head what the state agency is that's in charge of this, but it shouldn't be hard to find through the state Department of Natural Resources. It is a huge problem. And again, you mentioned power lines. Are some of these ash trees near power lines?
Correct, they are. They're along our local road.
Right. Then the power company may well want to be involved before the trees fall down. You should be able to get some financial help. I don't know if you can. One interesting place to start might be your homeowner's insurance. A lot of times, if you have problem trees that are near your home or other structures, your homeowners will help mitigate the possible damage rather than buy you a new garage or a new roof or a new half of a house. And your local agent may be able to help you with the right resources. But I know this is a huge issue in Pennsylvania, and that's where I would start with my homeowners and ask them what they know about this. The power company, I wouldn't necessarily rely on them to come out fast enough because, unfortunately, once a tree is infected, the homeowner's responsibility is to have it taken down and destroyed, burned, carted away, taken care of properly. And that all has to be done legally. How many trees do you have affected?
Probably half a dozen right now at this point, but there may be more.
Yeah, that's like, we're talking 10 grand. So that's like, you know, these are old trees, I presume, massive, wonderful trees. And trees are really expensive to remove, especially if they're near structures and everything like that.
Right.
And unfortunately, I can't tell you to like, well, just sit back and see what happens. Because if we're going to control the spread of this insect, which looks unlikely, but you got to try to do the right thing, you got to act quickly. So were I you, I would first call my homeowner's insurance, and then I would try to find the state EPA. They can direct you. Hopefully there is a program to help homeowners with these removal costs, but obviously you've already identified the bailout one for the trees that are near the power lines. One thing that has been good about these fierce storms we've had over the past couple of falls is the power companies have gotten much more proactive about taking down bad trees and are responding much more quickly. They had stopped doing that for a while. But I wish I could give you a name and a phone number or reassurance, but once the trees are infected, they need to be taken down and disposed of before the borers can move on to another tree. So, you know, there's a couple of thoughts, and I wish you luck, and I'm sorry about your trees.
Okay, thank you.
1-888-346-9499. Kathleen, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike. How are you?
I am doing fine. Kathleen, how are you today?
Kathleen in Cape May is just dandy.
In Cape May, all the way in Cape May, huh?
All the way, yes. And we are the end of New Jersey.
There you go. I knew somebody would be. So what can we do for Kathleen in Cape May?
Well, I'm a raised bed gardener. Actually, my neighbors and I, we kind of share the garden. We've got between the two of us 10 raised beds that are 4x8 made out of cedar. And one of the beds is dedicated to Yukon Gold potatoes. And it's the first time this bed has been planted, so there were no crop rotation issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I put them in mid March. I got the seed potatoes from a local garden center just in like a paper bag.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing great. And I'm eating the potatoes. They're wonderful. But all of a sudden, within the last week to 10 days, all of the plants are starting to turn yellow and brown and die. And they haven't gone through a flowering cycle yet. So wondering what I'm doing wrong.
Okay, so you planted them in March in a new raised bed. What was the raised bed filled with?
It was filled with a combination of screen topsoil, mushroom soil, and a little bit of sand.
Okay. Like you need more sand in Cape May?
Well, it's a raised bed, so, you know, the bed was empty. It was being filled for the first time.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of sand, but I don't think that did anything bad. And how deep did you bury the potatoes?
Maybe 6 inches down from
and then,
the top.
And then you got good greenery coming up.
Yeah, fantastic. I mean, just healthy and lush and looked great.
And did you mulch the bed then?
No. Uh-huh.
Okay. One thing I would always advise people to do when they plant potatoes is as soon as the green growth is up, that's when you want to put down an inch of shredded leaves all around the bed. Because as anybody who knows, who's grown potatoes in the past knows, the little suckers keep trying to get up above the soil line.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
And every part of the potato, the underground tuber that is exposed to sunlight, develops toxins that make it unsafe to eat. That's the
Well, I will say that I did not mulch, but as it started growing, I kept kind of mounding up around the potatoes to make sure nothing was exposed.
Okay, some people do that. I prefer to just put down a mulch. Now, you say you ate potatoes.
Yeah, I had roasted them last night with some carrots straight out of the garden. They were delicious.
So did you do this while the plants were still green, or was that after they gave up the ghost?
This I took it from the ones that gave up the ghost. I'm letting the green ones grow, and I'm harvesting from the not-so-green ones.
So you planted them in March, April, May, June. You never saw flowers, you're saying, and that was your big concern.
That was my thing. I thought you were supposed to harvest after the flowers, and there haven't been any flowers yet.
Well, typically what happens is, not potatoes don't always flower. Most of them do, admittedly. And then you're supposed to pull off those flowers if you see them. And then 3 weeks later, if you like, you can begin to dig up what are called new potatoes. Those are the smallest, tastiest ones.
Right.
So how many potatoes did you plant?
I put 18 in.
That's a lot of potatoes. So they were very small seed potatoes.
Yeah, they were about the size of a small child's fist.
Okay.
And I didn't cut them up.
Good.
Because I figured I'd have enough. And right now I'm harvesting, the potatoes are about, again, the size of a small child's fist.
The plants that have turned brown, there are lots of nice potatoes in the soil, right?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know that anything went wrong. I mean, you planted pretty early. Potatoes are a medium-level crop, but yours were in the ground for like 90 or 100 days.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just possible that either they didn't flower, they don't need to flower.
Okay.
You know, they're not a pollinated crop. It's fun to see the flowers. Oh, they might have flowered and a caterpillar or a slug could have eaten the flowers that night and you might never have seen it.
Okay.
But if you're harvesting a couple of pounds of nice potatoes for every seed potato you planted, that's perfect.
Oh, so we've done nothing wrong. This variety just for some reason didn't flower.
Well, exactly. And you're not using the flowers. The flowers are useless to you. But if you're getting good potatoes, you know, maybe they flowered and you missed it. Maybe they just didn't choose to flower. We had some crazy weather this spring. It was cold. It was wet. And you still have some plants that are nice and green, right?
They're green. They're not as lush and pretty as they would. Like, they look like they're going the way of the first ones where they start to yellow. And then the stalks yellow and then
I would suggest that they're done, that's as big as the potatoes are going to get, and that you harvest them and store them inside in a nice dark place, and you still have time to get that bed ready in plenty of time for some late season crops, some cole crops, some salad greens.
Mm-hmm.
And next year I would urge you to grow your potatoes in a nice loose bed. Instead of sand, I would use perlite to lighten the soil.
Okay.
And real compost instead of mushroom soil, and see if you get different results. But it looks like you got a great potato harvest, so stop complaining.
All right. Well, thanks, Mike. Love your show. Listen every Saturday.
Thank
you. I'm out in the garden.
Very good. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week, an unexpected yet beautiful benefit of wild violets. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please read us this week's so unusual question.
Sure, Mike. Connie, all the way up in Erie, PA, has a very unusual question. She writes, "What ate all of my wild violets? All that's left are the veins and the stems." This sure is a real change of pace. Generally, when we see wild violets in the subject line, the email is more like this one from Rolf in Alexandria, who writes, "We moved into a new house 2 years ago, and the back lawn was more weeds than grass. Despite the two large silver maples that shade the lawn, I have most of the weeds under control, but have not been able to control the spread of violets. It seems that the only way to control them would be to kill everything and start over, or dig them all up, an impossibility due to their sheer numbers. I tried mowing at a low setting to lop off the flower buds, but that goes against the normal advice of not scalping the lawn. It also didn't get rid of them."
Yeah, that is a lot more like our typical violet vituperation. Now, a number of things are going on in that email from Rolf, who unfortunately is taking the all-too-typical homeowner stance of, I'm going to grow a lawn there no matter how little chance I have of success. The basic truth is that even the most shade-tolerant grass needs 4 hours of sun a day. And even if it does get that much, Rolf is still going to have to contend with the intense competition for water and nutrients from those giant maple roots.
And I have a feeling that this low-mo brainstorm may have actually been more like lawnicide.
Oh, yeah. Grasses in shady areas need to be cut even higher than we typically recommend, at 3.5 inches, so they can have enough surface area to try and collect the minimum amount of sunlight they need to survive. Scalping, especially right before the season of summer heat stress arrives, will probably just turn that area into a dust bowl or a mud puddle, depending on what kind of weather he gets.
And don't you always say that wild violets are the best weeds at resisting removal?
Yes, they're the last things to exit a lawn. Despite their fragile look and ephemeral beauty, they are highly resistant to herbicides. The only sane way to remove them is by digging up and replanting the clumps.
But even that wouldn't give Rolf a shot at a nice lawn, would it?
Not with his conditions, no. In fact, he's one of the best candidates for a woodlawn garden I've seen in a long time. Instead of fighting this battle with nature that he can never win, he should just let the violets take over. They're so beautiful in the spring.
And edible.
Right, they look great on top of salad greens, and they contain large amounts of rutin, a nutrient that strengthens capillary walls and helps reverse the visible effects of varicose and spider veins over time.
That's if you get to eat them. It sounds like someone or something beat poor Connie to it. We still haven't offered her any help.
No, but a listener did. We picked Connie's email for our post of the day at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page last month. And I suggested there that the usual suspects were the culprits. Herbivores like deer, groundhogs, rabbits, and such.
But Connie said all that's left are the veins and the stems. Those plant eaters wouldn't be so choosy, would they?
No, and that's where our legion of Facebook friends really came in handy. Now, the first comment we got was from someone named Mary Martin, loved her in Peter Pan, and she was squarely on Rolf's side. "I know people who would welcome anything that eats violets," was her comment. But then Colleen Beattie of Delaware chimed in with the observation that a number of caterpillars require violets as food. "Keep an eye out for the butterflies they become," she wrote. "And if they are the culprit, maybe you should plant more violets next year."
And Colleen was right?
A plus and gold star right. I did a little searching and found a great article on violets as butterfly host plants at the website of the American Violet Society. Originally published as an article in the summer 2000 issue of their Violet Gazette, it explains that violets function as food for the caterpillars that go on to become fritillaries, large, colorful butterflies that look a lot like monarchs to the untrained eye.
But violets come and go so quickly in the spring. Aren't the flowers long gone before those big butterflies show up?
Well, Elizabeth Scott, the author of that article, explains that towards the end of summer, the adult butterflies lay their eggs in areas where they somehow know that the violets are going to appear the next spring. The eggs hatch, tiny little caterpillars emerge, spend the winter under leaf litter, and then start to nibble away when the violets appear and begin to flower, always feeding from below, so people rarely see them.
But you can't miss those big butterflies they turn into.
Nope. Looks like we have yet another reason to love our wild violets. Well, that sure was yet another reason to revere our violets now, wasn't it? Luckily for yous, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to feed me to baby caterpillars if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your target report, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org.
And please, please tell us where you live. Please, please. Oh, it's so important. Please, please, please.
And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Al Banks. Rich Abanowitz, who went playing in the Poison Ivy, and Sarah Kazar, who wisely did not, are You Bet Your Garden's webpage wonders. Rich, you're going to need an ocean of calamine lotion. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our editor is Al Banks. Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our hired hand is Matt Hudecky. I'm your host, high-flying Mike McGrath, and I'll be sure to fuel up on violets so I can see you again next week. For a while, they were truly forbidden fruit, against the law to grow. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal how gooseberries came back and why they are worthy of your attention. Plus your fabulous phone calls.